Okay, imagine this. You open up these ancient Jewish legal texts, right? And you stumble into this huge debate, a debate that could literally decide whether a marriage holds up or falls apart based on, well, clothing.
So it sounds strange today, maybe, but
Yeah.
we're talking about how much clothing is okay, or maybe even required,
Right.
or crucially, forbidden during marital intimacy, according to the sources, anyway.
So that's our deep dive today. We're looking at a really private subject, but one with very public, very serious legal consequences in Jewish thought.
Absolutely. We're drawing on everything from the Torah itself, the Talmud, later figures like Maimonides, the Rambam, and then getting into the Kabbalists, too. It's quite a journey.
And the core issue, the mission here, is to explore this tension, right, between this early ideal of total unashamed union and these later rules that seemed, well, really restrictive. Some sources even say these rules could ruin the lives of couples.
That's the conflict in a nutshell. You have Genesis talking about being naked and unashamed as perfect unity. And then centuries later, you get these interpretations, especially from Kabbalah, saying, wait, no, the man should actually stay partly clothed, specifically wearing the small tzitzit, the fringed garment.
Wow. Okay, that sounds like a direct clash, a real legal and, I guess, emotional contradiction. So let's unpack this. Where do we start? The absolute
Yeah, got
basics.
to start with the foundation. That's in the Torah, Exodus 21:10. It lays out the husband's non-negotiable duties. Shera kasuta vyonata lo yigra.
Which
He
means.
can't diminish her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. Those three things. It's the bare minimum, you know, the
Yeah.
absolute floor for a marriage in this view.
Okay, minimum standard. But then there's the ideal, right? You mentioned Genesis earlier. It's Genesis 2.
Exactly. Genesis 2:24-25. It says, the man should cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. And right after that, it paints the picture. They were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed.
Naked and unashamed. That seems pretty clear. No barriers.
That's the paradigm. Perfect unity, nothing held back, physically or emotionally. And the sources, they make an interesting point about fulfillment here.
How so?
Well, they suggest that for the wife, the enjoyment is maybe more tied to the emotional side, the psychological connection. It needs that deep love, that communication, the feeling of complete union. Becoming one flesh is key.
And for the husband, is it different?
The texts seem to imply that for the man, fulfillment might be derived more directly from the physical act itself, or maybe just from fulfilling the obligation, you know.
Yeah, okay. So the legal focus, the warnings about not diminishing her rights, are really aimed at ensuring the husband meets her need for that total closeness, both emotional and physical.
That seems to be the thrust of it, yeah. Protecting her experience of kirov baser, the closeness of the flesh.
Okay, so ideal is naked, unashamed unity. The minimum is ensuring her conjugal rights aren't diminished. How did the Talmud, the core legal text, translate that into hard rules? You mentioned something about a severe penalty.
Oh, yeah. The Talmud dives right into that word shira. It defines it specifically as kirov besar, closeness of the flesh. And based on that definition, it explicitly forbids something called the minhag parsiim.
The Persian custom? What was that?
It was apparently a practice where the couple would be intimate while still wearing clothes.
And the Talmud forbids that. What happens if someone insists on it?
This work gets really serious. Rav Huna states it clearly. If a husband makes it a condition, if he says, look, I'll only be intimate if I'm in my clothes and she's in hers. Well, he's obligated to divorce her.
Obligated to divorce.
Yes, and pay the full ketubah, the entire marriage contract settlement, which could be a huge amount.
Wow. Just for insisting on wearing clothes. What's such a drastic consequence? That seems disproportionate almost.
It seems so, but the reasoning goes back to that idea of Gora diminishing her. Insisting on clothes wasn't seen as modesty, it was seen as deep disrespect, a fundamental diminishing of her rights and her person.
How so? Like a barrier.
Exactly. A physical and an emotional barrier. It suggests the husband isn't seeking that complete mutual union, that kirov bear. Maybe he's just focused on his own release or ticking a box, fulfilling an obligation. It negates the whole point.
So the clothing becomes a symbol of holding back, of not fully committing to the one flesh ideal. And that failure is so fundamental, it breaks the contract, triggering the ketubah.
That's precisely the logic presented. That refusal of full union is a violation warranting the end of the marriage, legally speaking. It underlines the wife's right to intimacy without barriers.
Okay, that establishes a very clear baseline, permissive, focused on mutual connection, and legally protective of the wife's emotional experience. But history is rarely that simple, right? Restrictions started appearing.
They did. And pretty early on, actually, even within the Talmudic period itself, you get these let's call them ultra-restrictive views. The most famous comes from a rabbi, Yohanan ben Havai.
What did he say?
He listed specific acts during intimacy. Things like the woman being on top or looking at certain body parts, even talking during the act, and claimed they caused physical defects in any children conceived.
Oh, wow. That injects a huge amount of fear and anxiety into something meant to be unifying and joyful. How did the mainstream Talmud react to that?
They shut it down, explicitly. Mm. The ruling was Ein Halakha Yohanan ben Dahavai.
Meaning?
The law is not according to our Yohanan ben Dahavai.
Yep.
Flat-out rejection. Instead, they established the opposite rule, which was incredibly permissive.
Which was?
Essentially, yeah. A person does whatever he wants with his wife. Total freedom within the context of the marriage.
So the Talmud recognized the danger that layering on these specific scary prohibitions could actually damage the relationship, the very thing it was trying to protect.
It seems so.
Yeah.
And this permissive stance, this freedom, was cemented by probably the biggest legal authority later on, Maimonides, the Rambam.
What did Rambam say?
He codified it. He wrote very clearly, a person's wife is permitted to him, therefore he may do whatever he wants with his wife, and may kiss every limb he wishes. No ambiguity there. The tradition was one of freedom and joy.
So Torah, Talmud, Maimonides, all pointing towards permission, unity, no barriers, no fear-based rules.
Oh.
But you mentioned a conflict. Here's where things start to diverge.
This is where it gets really interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
Because centuries after Maimonides, another foundational legal figure, R. Yosef Karo, compiled his major code, the Shulchan Aruch. And he went against the grain. He directly contradicted the Talmud and Maimonides on some points.
Mm.
He wrote that looking at or kissing the area of intimacy is actually forbidden.
Forbidden? But the Talmud and Rambam explicitly permitted it. Why would he forbid it?
His reasoning was based on ideas of humility or maybe avoiding extra temptation. But the effect was to reintroduce the very kinds of restrictions the Talmud had specifically rejected.
The source material we're looking at is pretty critical of this, isn't it?
Very critical. It essentially argues that R. Karo lacked a direct legal tradition for this specific ruling, that he created a stumbling block, putting the word forbidden, where centuries of established law said permitted.
Creating unnecessary anxiety, basically, yeah. Interfering with the established freedom.
Exactly. It was seen by some later authorities as imposing a kind of personal stringency as universal law. But even this, while problematic, wasn't the biggest shift. The most dramatic deviation came from mysticism, from Kabbalah.
Ah, that's it. This is where that comes in.
This is it. Later Kabbalistic teachings, often linked to huge figures like the Ari, and cited by others like the Ben Ish-Chai, introduced a radical new requirement.
Which was?
That a man must never take off his small tzitzit, the fringed garment worn under the shirt, not even during intimacy.
Wait, never take it off? But hang on. Didn't the Talmud just say that if a man insists on wearing any clothing, he owes his wife a divorce payment because it diminishes her experience?
Precisely. You see the problem. It's a head-on collision.
It's not just a contradiction. It sounds like a direct violation of a Talmudic ruling designed to protect the wife. How could they justify requiring something that Talmud penalizes?
Well, the justification shifted. It wasn't about the wife's emotional experience anymore in this view. The tzitzit were seen as having this spiritual significance of a kind of protective boundary, maybe, during a very physical act. It prioritized a mystical idea over the established legal right of the wife.
So the Talmud says any garment is an emotional barrier and an insult justifying divorce. The Kabbalistic practice says this specific garment is a spiritual necessity, even if it creates that barrier.
That's the conflict, starkly put. It essentially sacrifices the wife's explicit legal and emotional rights, grounded in the Torah and Talmud, for a perceived mystical benefit.
How did they even attempt to square that circle with Genesis? With naked and unashamed, it seems impossible.
They tried. Some later Kabbalists wrestled with this. They looked at the Zohar, the foundational text of Kabbalah, which does sometimes talk about nakedness.
So the Zohar supported nakedness?
Sometimes, yes. But these later figures, like one known as the Kaf HaKaim, they sort of reinterpreted it. They argued, well, maybe nakedness was actually despised, unless the couple was covered by a blanket or a sheet.
A compromise. Mm. Trying to maintain some kind of physical barrier, some modesty, while still, you know, being technically naked underneath.
Kind of like that, yeah. An attempt to bridge the gap between the spiritual demand for the tzitzit, or at least profound modesty, and the physical reality of intimacy. But the author of our source material argues this whole Kabbalistic line of reasoning, the tzitzit requirement itself, is built on a massive misunderstanding, a fundamental error.
A misunderstanding. Okay, this sounds like the aha moment. What did they misunderstand?
They misunderstood the very Zohar text they were using to talk about naked union without a barrier. According to this analysis, the Kabbalists mistook a description of cosmic, divine processes for a ruling on human bedroom behavior.
Okay, slow down. The Zohar wasn't talking about people. What was it talking about?
It was talking about something called Yichud Elyon, supernal union. This is deep Kabbalistic cosmology, describing the unification of divine attributes or energies,
yeah.
Sometimes personified as deities.
Like gods uniting.
Sort of metaphorical deities, yeah.
Yeah.
Aspects of the divine. Specifically, the texts often refer to the union of the male aspect, sometimes called Katzar Apayim, and his female consort, Nukva. It's about how these abstract divine forces interact and unify in the heavens, you know.
So the Zohar is describing God or divine forces uniting without any spiritual barrier between them.
Exactly. And it uses a human analogy to explain this divine concept.
What analogy?
It uses the law about prayer. You know how there shouldn't be a physical barrier, like a wall, right, between you and the ark or the prayer space. The Zohar says, just like there's no barrier there, there's no barrier when these supernal forces unite. It was using a human rule as a metaphor for a divine event.
And the later Kabbalists, they took the metaphor about divine union and applied it literally back to humans, but in a twisted way, demanding a physical garment remain as some kind of spiritual necessity during human union.
That is exactly the argument presented in our source, that they mistook the analogy for the subject. They read a text about divine cosmology and thought it was giving instructions for human intimacy.
Which means the entire tzitzit requirement, this major deviation that caused so much conflict with earlier law, was based on a reading error, a fix for a problem they essentially invented by misinterpreting a mystical text.
According to this analysis, yes, a classic case, perhaps, of spiritualizing something to the point where the original human, legal, and emotional core gets lost or even violated. They sought spiritual elevation, but in this view, ended up contradicting fundamental legal principles designed to protect the marriage bond and the wife's well-being.
Wow. So this whole journey, this deep dive, it really highlights an incredible arc. We start with this clear, permissive tradition. Torah, Talmud, Maimonides, all saying yes to total union, no clothing barriers, no unnecessary fear. The focus is mutual joy and connection.
A tradition centered on emotional and physical fulfillment within the marriage. Very grounded.
And then it gets overlaid, even overridden, by this later, highly restrictive custom from Kabbalah, requiring the tzitzit, introducing fears based on Ar Yohanan ben Dahavai's rejected ideas or Arkura's stringencies, and potentially all stemming from a fundamental misreading of a cosmological metaphor.
It created generations of anxiety, potentially, convincing people that perfectly permitted, even encouraged, aspects of marital intimacy were somehow problematic or forbidden.
It really brings home that point from Maimonides you mentioned earlier, that forbidding what's permitted can be just as damaging as permitting what's forbidden. Both distort the tradition.
Both create unnecessary burdens and anxieties, yeah. They undermine the original intent.
What strikes me most, looking back at the earliest sources, is how they baked the emotional quality of the act right into the legal requirements. The husband's obligation wasn't just physical, it was about ensuring a loving, respectful, fully unified experience for his wife. That emotional connection was a religious duty.
It really was. The quality of the connection, the absence of barriers, the mutual respect, these weren't just nice ideas. They were legally mandated aspects of the relationship, protected by things like the ketubah penalty. It's quite profound.
It really is. And it leaves us with a pretty provocative thought, doesn't it? If these ancient texts show how easily a beautiful spiritual metaphor through misinterpretation could lead to imposing unnecessary, even harmful practical rules, where else in our lives today might we be doing something similar? Where do we take abstract ideals about connection or spirituality or success and twist them into rigid, self-imposed rules that actually undermine the very thing we're trying to achieve?
That's a powerful question to reflect on. How often do our attempts to elevate something actually end up complicating it or even damaging the simple, common sense core of love, connection, and mutual respect?